Good morning. How's everyone? So again, for assignment seven, if you are looking for an extension, just contact me and you can have one through the end of Sunday. But you got to ask. Okay? If you don't want to ask, then just get it done. Yes. On a per-person basis?
Okay.
Yes. No, I'm not doing it for the class.
Okay.
No, I'm doing it individually. And I'm doing this on purpose because there's another assignment that you can be working on Friday. And for most of you, you'll be better served to just go ahead and get this assignment over with before you get the next one. But if you have something else you have to prioritize, then okay. But so how is assignment seven going? Okay? So I think there's some things I may tell you about today that may help. If you have questions specifically about assignment seven, I want to wait until the second half. And I can potentially start going over some of the code and talk you through some of it. But before that, I want to talk in a little more general terms and talk more about file systems. Yes?
I saw your comment on the forum about the cross-reference.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know what a synth writable is. Synth underscore writable. Like, I was looking at it online. It's like a...
Is that in the code?
Yeah, it's not in your code. It's like in the Linux cross-reference.
Sorry. There's 50 million lines of code in Linux cross-reference. You know how many symbols in there that I have no clue about?
Alright, so...
Don't!
Also, how... Like,
don't look in the Linux cross-reference and try to read it. Look in your in the code I've given you. Look at the functions that are not defined in that code and look at the Linux cross-reference or just Google those symbols to try to figure out what those are. So this is part of what I'm going to talk about today.
Which we'll get down to operating system specifics, but I'm going to start at a more general level first, which is this issue of abstraction. So I've gotten some feedback that a lot of you just aren't comfortable with this whole idea of a module. What is this module thing? And I tried to explain it in specific terms, but I realized I was explaining in specific terms, but I don't know if you have the general concept down, which I find a bit funny, but I can kind of see given what's covered in your classes up to now. So I don't think this will be redundant. If it is, you say, I've already learned this, feel free to raise your hand and then talk about what you think you know and stuff and we can go from there. Let's start a little basic. So, if you consider yourself any sort of computer scientist, and frankly, if you consider yourself a software person of any kind, I don't say which term because there's so many terms for describing what people do with computers, but if you're interested in making computers do things at any sort of programmatic level, the world you live in is one of abstractions. You may think at times you're dealing with things that are actually real or communicating to real hardware, stuff like that, but almost always that's a fiction. That's not actually what's happening. You think you're writing assembly layers code which gets translated directly into machine code, and that's actually what the computer runs. But of course, if you start learning about how processors work, you realize, whoa, that's actually just a whole high-level abstraction to a whole bunch of low-level stuff that actually happens in the microprocessor. When you think you're dealing with things like, oh, I'm doing low-level I/O because I'm dealing with files, from this class you're like, wait, files, this whole big abstraction on top of things. We're always dealing, when I say we're dealing with abstractions, we're dealing with these abstract entities that are instantiated through other things, whether it's instantiated through code or instantiated through hardware. So abstraction is not a new concept for you all. You should have seen this. You know, this is something that's talked about all over the place. But I think this class is probably the first one where you come up with the reality of what abstractions mean in practice.
which means that you're going to go out there in the real world and you're going to deal with programs that you have no clue about. They're going to be big programs, typically million line plus programs. But even if they're smaller programs, still, they're going to be full of things that you just don't understand. And you're going to be tasked with debugging this, making patches to it, improving to it, adding to it. I mean, you're almost never going to have a clean slate where you're going to say, oh, just write your program from scratch. Yet every program, well, almost every programmer I know, much, much prefers to write things from scratch than to make changes to an existing code base. Think about this. This is a little funny because I said good programmers should be smart and lazy. And in general, it's a lot less work, or you would think it should be, to take an existing program and modify it for your own ends versus taking it, taking that program, taking a complete blank slate and writing a program from scratch to do what you want. Yet time and time again, if you look at what programmers do and the way they talk about things, it's like, oh, this is such a mess. This code is so ugly. It's so, they come up with all kinds of things about the code. I just want to throw it all away and start over. So whenever programmers, and I say this as myself, I say this as you, I say this as all of us, say that you want to start over, what it really means is that this code has abstractions that I don't understand, and I don't want to, or I feel like I can't understand these abstractions. And so it's much easier for me to throw away the code, because then I can just use the abstractions that I already understand, that are already in my head, and create code based on that. Now, wait a second. Why can't you just understand the abstractions? Because understanding abstractions is fundamentally harder than understanding the code itself. Because understanding the code itself is just saying, oh, that's an if statement. Oh, that's a for line. Oh, here's a function. Understanding code at that level is not hard. If you can program at all, you can basically read code at that level. But that's not what we're talking about here. When we talk about here, we try to understand, why is this function here? What is its role in fulfilling some task or some role that I don't understand? And you know, this is why often people say, oh, you have to properly document your code. But what is really documenting code about? It's really about documenting the abstractions in the code. It's not about telling how the code actually works. You can read the code to see how it works. Abstractions say, why is the code the way it is? Why is it organized? So the reason why I'm talking about this abstractly first is because when you look at the modules I gave you, you're dealing with a very small amount of code that's supposed to fit into this much larger program, which we call the Linux kernel. And that means you have to play by its rules. You have to live with its abstractions. And you don't understand all those abstractions. I don't understand all those abstractions. It's a big program. So now you're facing this fundamental problem of, I don't understand this. So how do I program with it? So you get into the cycle when you start dealing with large programs of you have to spend most of your time trying to understand the code. To add one line of functionality, you might think, oh, I can write one line of code, no problem. Yeah, you might be able to write one line of code, no problem. But understanding what line of code you should put into this larger thing may take you hours and hours and hours, maybe days, weeks, maybe even months. Hopefully not years. But it can take a substantial investment because you have to come back and understand what these abstractions are. So you can understand, why is this program written that way? I mean, there's so many tales of programmers going in, looking at code and going like, oh, that code makes no sense. Let me fix it. Let me clean it up. And they break it. completely because they didn't understand what it was doing. They didn't understand the abstraction. They didn't understand the contract. They didn't understand the guarantees that one particular bit of code was supposed to provide to the rest of the system. They didn't understand the circumstances of it. They just didn't know what was going on. So understanding a large code base is not all about understanding abstractions. You have to also understand some of the details, but you start with the abstraction so you can navigate around. I mean, this is not a random jumble of code. Some sentient entity, maybe with some automated help, put this code together with some purpose. That's what you can assume with computer systems in general. So there is a reason for it to be the way it is. Your task is to figure out why is it that way. And once you understand why, then you can understand how. But if you don't understand the why, you'll never understand the how. Questions? So that's the question. How do you understand the abstractions? There's no straightforward way of doing this. Part of it is, of course, reading the code. Part of it is looking at the documentation. Part of it is trying to understand what the problem is that the code is trying to solve. But the fact is, the way you come to understand abstractions is by seeing. This is what an experienced programmer brings to the table, is that they have seen lots of code. They've seen lots of abstractions, lots of ways way problems are broken down. So when they see a new project, they can look at a little bit of the code and they go like, oh, they're doing things this way. Oh, I bet the code's done like this. Oh, yep, it's that way. They have an entire model in their head that they can fit. They have multiple models. They can pick which one and say, oh, this code is following this pattern. So whenever they talk to you about design patterns and stuff, this is that's a distillation of this idea. But the design patterns is just a piece of it. And it's being able to look at code and say, why is this organized this way? You'll say, well, it's organized this way. If you're doing this sort of thing, you must have this kind of problem. Okay, what's that problem? And then you know how to approach it. So there is no, so I can't tell you, okay, do this, and you're done. It's very specific. But what I'm hoping you get to get a little bit experience in this class, just a little bit, is in trying to deal with that, of facing a code base where you don't understand what the heck's going on and picking away a little bit at it. And the way you're picking away at it, in part, by looking at the textbook, is in part by listening to me lecture about it, is in part by you going through exercises to try to understand things. But that, more than anything else, being able to deal with these large code bases, I think, is the most useful thing you can take out of a class like this. Because you probably won't be most of you probably will not be hacking on operating systems. I mean, you'll be using them, but you'll probably be using high enough level abstraction that you don't have to think with the low level details most of the time. But you'll be diving into large code bases all the time and deal with systems you don't understand. So along those lines, I want to spend a bit of time talking about a design pattern that operating systems came up with in order to deal with the problem. And that problem was file systems. So we talk about file systems, we're talking about files. And so we're talking about files and we're talking about the file storage. So just looking at the simplest file systems, the earliest file systems, you had some sort of storage device, and you had some way of organizing the data on that storage device into some sort of data structure. And then you had APIs for accessing that. Originally, in Unix systems, there was just special files, a little bit of special case code for handling special files, and then there was the native file system. There was the block device. And in fact, all the special files were also implemented through that. They were just weird files on disk that had these
major numbers and minor numbers and mark this block or character. And then when the kernel saw those, it needed to do something special. Otherwise, it just, you know, read the data from disk or wrote data from disk and so on. But Sun Microsystems, in the 80s, decided they didn't want to have a Unix system just run on one computer. Well, what they wanted to do was actually have a bunch of computers, a bunch of workstations, network together using this new, you know, pretty newfangled technology of Ethernet, which is starting to become popular. And they wanted them to be able to share resources. They wanted them to be, they still wanted them to be independent computers, each running their own kernel and stuff, but they wanted them to communicate with each other and share resources. So that it'd be like I could use many different computers like I was using one. So as part of the development of that, they wanted to create a way to access files on other computers. So there were two. But one abstraction they created was for block devices. That was for allowing the access of block devices on another computer. This ended up not being very popular for a very simple reason. If you give access at the level of a block device, you're generally assuming exclusive access. Only one computer can access that data structure, because file systems are not designed for concurrent access. How would you mediate who's updating this inode or not? That's not what it's designed for. So it doesn't scale particularly well. Because they say, oh, it's giving you a remote disk. Say, okay, my computer doesn't have a disk. I mean, they actually call it diskless workstation. So you had a computer, it doesn't have a disk, so it'll boot over the network, and part of another computer's hard disk will appear to be the disk for this one. What the abstraction that did take off, the network thing that did take off, is simple NFS. NFS for network file system. So I'm not going to describe, so there's some stuff in the book I think about NFS. We're not going to talk too much about NFS. The reason why I'm bringing up NFS is because this forced the Sun engineers to go into their kernel and go like, well, darn it. Every time we access a file now, we have to account for the fact that the file might be local or the file might be on some other computer, you know, across the network. Not across the world, but we're sitting across a local area network. How do we don't want to change every part of our kernel to deal with this, and we certainly want any sort of user space program not to know the difference. So regular user space, they don't know where the file is. I mean, another computer could be locally, they just see a file. Kernel is going to have to deal with the fact that the file may be local or it may be on another computer, and it has to deal with it appropriately. So inside of the SunOS kernel, they had to create an abstraction. And the abstraction layer is called the VFS. Virtual file system. So they abstracted away the notion of what was a file system. They said a file system, you could say, oh, a file system deals with blocks and storage and things and all the sorts of things. No, that's not what a file system is. Some file systems might do that, but that's not fundamental. What's fundamental to a file system is the API. What defines a file is how you can access it. So they wanted to make it so that any part of their kernel could access different kinds of files on different kinds of file systems transparently. So they had to add an abstraction into the kernel to do this. So if you're engineering this, what does this look like? I want to be able to have So what is the API for a file system? It's things like, well, I've got to be able to do mount it, unmount it. I've got to be able to add it into the file system and move it. I've got to be able to do things with directories. And I've got to be able to do things with files. Open, close, B, C, right. All the kind of standard file system operations you want to do with this. So I want any part of the kernel that when an open comes up for a specific file, it chooses which open to call based upon the file system that the file is part of. So what does this sound like in terms of programming styles, patterns, things that you've encountered up to this point?
Polymorphism,
virtual functions. You know, this is the whole thing of, you know, subclassing. I mean, this is basic object-oriented kind of design. You know, you specify an interface, and then you specify an implementation. That's all this is. But note, this was all done before object-oriented languages were developed. And in fact, this kind of patterning in code is what motivated the development of object-oriented languages. Because programmers were trying to create these kind of abstractions, and they realized, oh, wouldn't it be helpful if the programming language itself helped enforce some of the constraints of it? So whenever you see things like, when I talk about APIs, I talk about abstractions and things, a lot of the stuff inside operating systems is very object-oriented. But it's mostly written in languages like C. So object orientation without an object-oriented language. The mechanisms are implemented from scratch. So part of understanding what's happening is realizing that you're seeing patterns that are designed to simulate object-oriented type behavior without underlying language support. It's being cooked up on the fly. And that's why the Linux kernel makes use of things like there's various macros that are made use of, and there's types and things. I mean, there's certain conventions that are used throughout the kernel. And the way you should interpret them is saying, that's kind of object-like. Now, of course, since you're implementing this from scratch, you would have to follow the patterns that make sense that are dictated by a specific language. You follow the patterns that make sense for your application. It's an advantage and it's a disadvantage.
So how do you do this? In C, I have an API.
I have a set of functions I want to call, and I want to call these functions in certain circumstances. But which exact function I want to call, I know what kind of function each one has a specific role, but what's the instance of it? I don't know. I'll have to figure it out at runtime. Chatty structures. So function pointers. So yeah. So what building blocks do we have? Function pointers. So when you have a function pointer, you have to specify what the arguments are for the function. Any function that's pointed to by a function pointer, you normally have to specify, okay, it has these arguments and it has this return value. So you specify the signature of the function. But then you have multiple implementations of that function that all follow that, and then you switch the pointers. What else do we use? That's not really a language feature, see. What else do we have? Structs.
You have structs, And we have function pointers.
That's it. That's basically all we got. And that's all we need. So what's the pattern?
So an API gets mapped to a struct of function pointers. Now, if you wanted to actually make this more object-like, as opposed to just specifying an interface, you would then have this associate with the struct certain data. But that's not the way the Linux kernel typically does it. What you normally have is you have certain structs. Well, I take that back. It does do that sometimes. But the way it would normally do it is you have certain structs that are just data. And you have other structs that consist of, that define an API and that have a bunch of function pointers. And if you have a struct that has data in it, and you want to refer to what API to use to interpret it, you then have a pointer to another struct that specifies the API. So where have you seen this? You know, in your module code, what have you seen this there? Was there a piece of this that fits this pattern?
There's a struct that had all the redirect operations.
Exactly. BFOps.
FOps. File system operations. That's what it's talking about by FOps. File system operations. So the notion is that you're specifying a little, you're not specifying an entire file system here, but you're saying for this special file, how do I implement read? How do I implement write? What does seek mean on this? And the conventions are is that you specify this struct by default. It's all going to be initialized to zero. You get this new struct, it's just going to be all zeros. So you just have to specify the function for the operations you want to implement. And then the operations you don't want to implement are assigned nulls. And then what can the kernel do? It will figure this out and will then use a generic version of the implementation for that file operation. Or, actually, I take that back.
It can use a generic operation, actually, but I think here what it does is it says that's not implemented for this function, and it just returns an error. You wanted to do right now, with the device that's there, a special file, by default, it only implements read. It doesn't implement write. So what happens when you do a write operation to it? Did it write? Did it succeed? Have you tried this? Can't write to it. Of course, normally you can't write to it because the permissions are set to be read-only. Since the permissions are read-only, you're not going to be, it's just going to say, okay, operation not permitted because it's not by permission. But if you change the permissions and you try to do a write, you're not going to crash the kernel. What's going to happen is it's going to go, hey, I don't know how to do that for the special file. Oh, well, return an error. Operation not, I think there's actually a specific error, but operation not implemented or something. I forget, I haven't really tested out the exact error conditions, but
for a special file, you have some operations that you can do on regular files you may not be able to do on that file. For example, if you have certain kinds of character files corresponding to, say, a printer, and you're sending output to a printer, does it make sense to implement seek? What would it mean to, if you send characters to the printer, how would you seek along that character string? How do you change your position? You're writing bytes. Or maybe you're reading bytes. It's a communications channel. Seek that has no meaning. So what happens when you try doing seek? I can't do seek.
So when we talk about file systems, we're taking this idea that, oh, I can implement the read and write operations for a specific special file and generalize. We're saying this isn't true for just one particular file, but it's for an entire file system that's mounted in a specific location. And what it's actually doing on the back end in order to get the data, the file system could be, oh, let me go across the network and grab data. But you can do it in lots of other ways. Like, for example, you could make a file system that implements the digits of pi. You go like, what? Well, let's say it just does, the top level directory would be say 3. And then maybe at the next levels are like every 3 digits, it does something. Maybe let it be a very narrow file system without 3, then 1, then 4, then 1. That's kind of boring. It doesn't have to store anything. You can compute it on the fly. All you would need to implement it to make a file system that outputted digits of pi is you'd have to, the top level, the file system would be which digit of pi do you want. And so the way you specify it is by your directory name, your path to it would be some encoding of how many digits you want. It's like, I want the first 100 digits or something. So maybe each one is like the 10 or 100. I was making this up. But what I'm trying to say is, there's no reason for storage to be behind a file system. It could be an arbitrary function. I mean, you saw this already with the special file, that this is a file that generates an infinite number of ones. Does that file that generates an infinite number of ones, does that have to store an infinite number of ones? No, of course not. It just outputs ones whenever you ask for it. You could have easily made that exact same thing, output the digits pi. You would just have to do something that could keep track of how many characters have been outputted and output that many, those digits of pi. But the same thing, instead of it just being a file, it can be an entire file system. Make that file system behave however you want. So you want to do, I want to access some cloud storage repository. Well, I can just write some API for reorganizing it. Well, actually, I don't have proper cloud storage that implements a proper file system API, but I have an email account that can store essentially unlimited numbers of emails. Can I use that to store files? Yes. Back when Gmail came out, Gmail had so much storage for free. Some people said, I want to use that just to store files. And people made things that acted like file systems with the back end storing them in email messages. That should make you go like, that seems kind of bizarre. It is completely bizarre. But the fact is, what do you have to do? You just have to implement, how do I open a directory? How do I, implement with tags or something, coding, and then say, how do you read it? How do you write it? Now I'll generate a new draft of myself or something. Like, you just have to come up with a mapping. And if you do this right, and your operating system provides the appropriate abstractions, the rest of your system doesn't know that it's talking to Gmail to get its files. It doesn't care. It just gets them. So this is throughout the Linux kernel, is you have these APIs that are defined. The most prominent is this thing of saying called the file system API. But when we go to this file system API, it's actually multiple APIs, because it's an API for directories, it's an API for inodes. And then there's things for the APIs for like caching, thing called dentry stuff, which are this internal caching stuff. And then there's abstractions for the whole virtual memory for pages and other things.
all of these things implement APIs that are instantiated in other parts of the kernel. But they're defined as APIs with these kind of structs, with these function pointers and stuff, because people create new implementations. They'll create alternative implementations, and then you can just plug them in. I mean, there's even this sort of thing for the scheduler. And I say scheduler, I'm talking about the CPU scheduler. There's also an I/O scheduler, and there's multiple implementations of that. So it has something like this. So if you want to start modifying the Linux kernel to do new things, you have to understand these APIs. And now, but this is really kind of funny here, because all it is a struct with function pointers, with some sort of signature for those. What are those functions really supposed to do? What should they return in different circumstances? How should the data be formatted in the struct that you're looking for the data to be? Yeah, there are types, but they don't really tell you how the rest of the system expects the things to be. So how do you figure this out? How do you figure out how this stuff is supposed to be used? There's really only one reliable way. Look at its use inside the Linux kernel. So the classic way I do, if I want to make the Linux kernel do something new, I look in the kernel for something that does something close to what I want to do. And because the Linux kernel is so big, there's often some bit of code somewhere that does something kind of like what I want to do. If it already did what I want to do, I wouldn't have to implement it. But it does something kind of like what I want to do. I know I'll take some of this, some of this. I mean, this is just like you all trying to assemble your solutions by looking at Stack Overflow answers. Okay, this is kind of like this. This is kind of like this. This is why I don't necessarily try to prevent you from doing that, because it is a useful skill. But it's only a useful skill if you're really trying to understand what's happening. If you just cut and paste wildly and just put things together, I mean, you get things that might work, might not, but if you're in something like the kernel space, small errors are just going to bring your entire system down. So what you instead need to do is try to understand, what's the pattern of this code? Why is it doing that? Oh, it just called that function. Why is it calling it there? Why can't I delete that call? It makes no sense to me. Okay, well, then you look at that function. What does it actually do? Okay, it's calling this. Oh, no. Wait, it's actually, And you find out this entire part of the Linux kernel you didn't understand, that now was pointed to by that one line of code you didn't understand. So I'm going to take a break in a second here, but how is this feeling? Helpful at all for trying to understand what you're doing with modules. You're dealing with APIs, APIs implemented using conventions and very low-level mechanisms. You have to recognize the patterns, figure out what they're supposed, why are they there, and then figure out the details. So, like, what did you have to do for one of the questions? Is implement a write functionality for this file. How are you going to do that? Well, first you have to figure out, what does it mean to add write functionality? Well, you've got to, you might guess, there's a file operation struct. You have to add a write method. What's the pattern for the write method? Well, just like the read one, there's a write one. Well, what's the function signature for the write one? Well, you got to look around. It turns out some of the code I referenced to you actually implemented a write function. Actually had a write operation. So if you looked at that code, you would have said, oh, here's the signature for the write operation. And you stick in that write operation. And then now you have to actually implement a little bit of code to do that. Now what I could have done was I could have left the write operation implemented, and I could have had a little blank function there, and then you could have just filled in the blank. But the point of the exercise was for you to see, oh, look, how do I get new things to happen? I have to figure out how this API fits together by looking at other code and seeing what the pattern is in other code and then implementing it myself. Again, the pattern you're trying to find. It's like, okay, you did read things. Well, let's do write. And if you mess up the function signature, it will, during compilation, say, okay, you're not actually matching the right signature for that function. You've got to declare it differently. So there's some things to help you along the way, but
And in fact, the number of lines of code you're probably going to write is going to be like 10 lines. But those 10 lines depend on you having now this mental model of what abstraction you're programming.
Cool. So I will pause there for 5 minutes. So it's 9:17, so 9:22. Okay.
So this is more of a high level
discussion. Then let's talk. Now I want to talk a bit about this module thing. And in order to talk about modules, we have to talk about extending applications. So you have an application. You want to add functionality to it. Typically, you want to allow. Now, if it's just your application, you want to add functionality to it, you just hack everything. But what if you want to allow others
to add code to your application?
How do you do it? How do you allow them to do it? Now, if it's open source, you could say, oh, well, hack on the code. But even if it's open source, that's probably not what you want to do, because you as the main developers will be developing their code along, and then other people will be developing their code. And if I make changes to my program and someone else was depending upon the old version, now all of a sudden they go like, wait, I was adding functionality and you just changed everything and now my code broke. What's a classic thing like this? Okay, Minecraft. We want to write mods for Minecraft. We want to add functionality to it. So what happens when Minecraft core changes? Oh, wait, all the mods break. And they have to be changed. To the new version of Minecraft. Depending upon the kind of mod it is, it may take less or more work. So good application design tries to good extension functionality design tries to minimize the problems that arise when your main code changes. You don't want things to change. Now,
an operating system, in a sense, is a manifestation of this.
You're in a sense always, you could say running programs that are an operating system is almost like extended. But of course it doesn't really feel like that.
But that's kind of what you're doing every time you're extending an application. It's almost an operating system-like thing. Like, oh, I just want to run things on top of it. And I want to use the existing functionality of the application, but I want to use it for new ends.
I want to use the operating system, take its functionality, and use it for new ends by an application. I want to use an application, extend its functionality with my extension.
So that's the purpose. That's the structure. So how do I do this?
How do I make it so that the extension can do things, can be very flexible, yet doesn't break the core functionality?
Again, we're just talking about APIs.
Find an application programming interface. That's why I call it. You want it. When you're extending an application, you're programming the application. So that's what API means. It's an application programming interface.
Okay, it's an API. What does that mean? How does it look? And how much does it actually limit what you can do? So when I say that, it's okay, it's fine you have an API, but then you have to have a decision of where does the extension code live? In process? is it is the third-party code inside your process, or is it outside of the process?
So yeah, that's what I'm trying to explain. So when it's outside of the process, that's kind of the easiest thing. It means you've just got another process.
You could say most of what we do in extending an operating system, we're just running processes on them. And what does it mean to run separate processes? It means they're isolated from each other. They can share files. They can share resources. You can have them maybe talk to each other via sockets or the things they can communicate. But fundamentally, they're living in different address spaces. They can't see each other's code. You can't call their functions directly. They're in separate universes. And if you want them to talk to each other, you have to add in specific mechanisms.
If you want to have one process talk to another via some sort of API, you have to specify some sort of protocol. Maybe it's a network protocol, maybe it's something for shared memory or something, but you specify some way of communicating. So outside the process, you have a protocol. Because they're communicating. In a standard way for communicating, is the protocol. But if you're in the process, you're in there. You're equivalent to any other code inside that application. So you can just call it. If there's a data structure, you can just access it. There's a function. You just call it. You just do whatever the heck you want. But is that a good idea? Wait.
The good part about it is it's very efficient because you're just as fast as any other code in the system, in the application.
If you have a protocol, you have to communicate. You can't share any state. You've got to send data this way, that way. You've got to organize it in some sort of format, and you've got to decode it, and it's got to go between different, you know, got to do context switches and stuff and things. I mean, it's much more overhead. If you're inside of the process, you're a first-class citizen. You can do anything any other code does. So everything is fast, fast, fast.
I'm saying that it's loaded into the same address space. I'm saying what happens is your application literally goes to disk, says, oh, here's some code, and it loads it in. And basically the same kind of mechanism as loading a shared library. Dynamic libraries, you can do the same thing. Dynamic libraries don't just have to be loaded when the program is first executed. They can be loaded at runtime. Basically the same mechanism. Just map it into your address space, load the file up, and then call some function, call some standard initialization, and then let it run.
So in process, so you really hear it's a linking standard.
Because that's what you're doing, is just like adding a library to your code. What it is, what's the process.
Load it in, patch some pointers typically, make sure your main code calls it at some point to make sure it gets incorporated, and then it does its stuff. So if you're loading it directly into the process, technically speaking, you don't need an API. The API is the entire program. You just call whatever functions. But is that what you want to do? No. But the reason why you don't want to do that is because the program you're extending will change. The original developers will muck things up for you. They'll say, oh, well, we're going to move this function, or we're going to rename this, or we're going to change this data structure to have an extra entry. They'll do all kinds of crazy things. If your code is being developed out of tree separately, you won't see those changes. And so the next time a new release comes out, your code is going to break. going to have to have scrambling for fixing it. So the idea of an API is it's a contract. It's the developer saying, this is how you can talk to my code. It is. It's a layer abstraction. It's an abstraction. It's saying, here's how you can access my code. Here's the things you can count on. We'll try not to break you when we change our code, unless we change our API. If we change our API, then we'll tell you. Or we might not tell you, but then we're bad developers. Such is life in the software world. But you should always be looking at these different strategies of extension, because you can't tell what you're doing actually by the API. Because the API is just kind of more of an abstract thing of saying, okay, you give me this thing, and I give you this back. They can be implemented either in process or outside of process. And in fact, they can move depending on the system. For example, browser plugins. Browser plugins, you add things like Flash and stuff originally to a browser. Originally, it was an in-process extension. It would be linked in to the web browser so that it had full functionality, just like the rest of the web browser, and could do anything. What? No, it flopped when the problem with this happened when there were security problems in those plugins. Because it means when the plugin was compromised, your entire browser was compromised. Or just when your plugin crashed, the entire browser crashed. And so what did Chrome and increasingly Firefox do? They said, screw that. We're going to take that plugin and we're just going to chuck it outside of the process and put it into a separate one. And then we'll have some sort of communication protocol with that process and talk to our to the main browser process. And if that one crashes, instead of the whole browser going down, you get the O snap. You've all seen O snap, right? In Chrome. Just this little thing is saying, oh, the plugin crashed. Then you just reload the page and it'll reload the plugin and it's all fine. And it does that because it's taken it out of the process. Older browsers, they couldn't do that. It was running inside the process. And it was running inside the, inside there because for performance reasons. And there's a price to be paid for performance. We do this. And this is part of the reason why most modern browsers, if you're not on the desktop, if you're on any sort of mobile, tablet device, or the Metro environment for Internet Explorer, the Metro environment on Windows, browsers don't take plugins because they're not safe. It turns out even when you try to isolate them as a process, the isolation is good because the API defined for it is actually very intrusive. It can mess with all kinds of ways the browser, so it's still not that safe. It's better, but not great. So they just closed it off. They killed that API. So question with those. So you see this pattern throughout software development. And what normally happens is oftentimes you start with an application and the application starts to say, okay, I don't want any way to extend it. And then people go, oh, please, I want to extend it. And then someone says, oh, I'm going to hack on it. And they come up with third-party ways of just messing with the code, hacking it, and sticking their code in. They go, like, oh, okay, fine, I'll give you an API. Or the API, and this becomes mature. Well, initially, when it's immature, every time there's an update to the application, it breaks the API, and then all the extensions have to be changed. Then developers like, okay, fine, we'll try to maintain a contract. And then we'll stick to that. And then things are happier. And if you keep doing that, eventually the application turns into part of the operating system. It's kind of what's almost happened with web browsers. Originally there was sort of this application for doing one task, and then they became an infrastructure on which all kinds of other things depended. And thus they become more and more an operating system service. With a specific API that's guaranteed. Why do people say that JavaScript is going nowhere? I will tell that when I teach 24/6, JavaScript is going nowhere at all. It'll be around probably for the rest of your career. At least. And the reason why I say that is because it's baked into the API of the web. That's the web. The programmatic interface of the web is JavaScript. You might want to program in some other language. You might hate it. You might want to do it. But that's the API. That's the way things talk.
So you might be able to hide it, but it's going to still be there. I've heard JavaScript called the assembly language of the web. And when you think of things like ASM.js,
side discussion. But. So where is this common with modules?
Most of the time, you extend an operating system out of process, out of the application process. You grab this operating system kernel that's in control of everything. What is the standard OS diagram?
Your applications, all running on top of a kernel. Hardware down here, but these are the applications siloed off from each other.
This is the same architecture that's used every time you extend an application.
The only difference is classically, if you're just extending an application, if you load it in process, well, you get rid of this line. There isn't a context switch to the thing. It's just, yeah, there's this thing here, this code, but this is effectively loaded in. Most of the time in an operating system, we want to keep that protection there because that's what keeps our system running. If this code misbehaves, it doesn't take down your entire system. Memory protection is helpful. It also lets you manage resources because we can run multiple things in parallel, either on multiple cores or even on the same core. Lots of benefits for separating this off. But we don't always want to do that. Sometimes we want to add code directly to the kernel. We want to do the in-process extension but to the operating system itself.
That's all a Linux kernel module is.
It's like a browser plugin for the kernel. You're just sticking code in here. There is
an API for Linux kernel modules. There are standards for how it's supposed to interact with the rest of the kernel. There are certain symbols you're supposed to access and certain symbols you're not supposed to access.
Or considered private or considered public. But you're in the same address space with all of the other kernel code. So you can do whatever the heck you want. That was the point in the tutorial of trying to access an invalid code and then try to crash it. You just start writing the memory randomly and you'll crash it. What's even better is you can actually crash virtual boxes too. Do you want any of you to do that? If you're really nasty with how you write to memory, you can crash virtual boxes. Because it turns out the protection provided by the virtual machine actually is not perfect. Because they wouldn't make things fast. So, what does this all mean? That's all a module is. It's just code being put here to extend the functionality of the kernel. If you go to the operating system research literature, this problem of how to extend the functionality of an operating system is one that has received a lot of attention. And there's a lot of different architectures and approaches that have been taken. And in fact, when we talk about microkernels, what we're really talking about is how do you extend the functionality of an operating system? What they're saying is don't have a big kernel, make a small kernel. And put everything, all this functionality that's here, into separate processes. And then talk to this and talk to each other via specific APIs. Well, so the criticism of it is it makes it slower because you have all these context switches. You have all these switches between these things. And also, you may want to actually share data structures and things between these things. Instead, now you're going to have to pass them as data or try to arrange shared memory. It increases complexity, and it reduces performance. But the argument for doing this is that, but look, I can replace these components while the system is running without crashing the system. If any of these fail, I can just restart it. It makes it much easier to extend the functionality of the system at runtime to increase the robustness, that security benefits. Should we be building for it? Well, we can. The research problems, we can make this fast and make this all work, just it'll work better. And
turns out in practice, sometimes this is a tension. Yes?
What? Well, how do you know if a child's process has died? Remember? When your child process dies, it sends a signal to the parent, same child. It might just hang or something. So then you have an API that has to have like a keep alive thing and say, okay, if it stops responding to messages, time out, then terminate it. But you're right, there's no simple way of doing this. Because now the main process has to look into the has to figure out what the computational state of this other entity. It's opaque to it in first approximation. Yeah, it might be doing who knows what. But if it's not responsive, why does your operating system, you know, there's a classic thing now in almost every desktop operating system. It says, this application is not responding. Would you like to terminate it? You choose. Is it busy doing something or has it actually died? That's up to the operator to decide this. And that's because it's the same kind of thing. Outside of the main program, there's something else that's looking at it going, hey, I'm not getting any messages back. I told it to do a lot of things, and it's not doing it. It died or not. This is the halting problem. Will this thing halt? Will it actually respond to me again or not? I don't know. You wait for a while, and then you go, well, it might have unclogged itself in 10,000 years, but I'm not willing to wait 10,000 years. So you kill it. These fundamental CS problems, if you look at what we do on a daily basis, we hack around them.
So this whole microkernel thing, I mean, this is an ongoing debate. I mean, people kind of do this. And it keeps changing. Like I said, the Windows NT started off as a microkernel design. When they first developed, they said, oh, we're going to go, you know, following operating system research, we're going to build a nice microkernel, and we'll do these. And then they found they had a certain problem, which was graphics was slow. So what'd they do? They shut the entire graphics subsystem into the kernel. What was that benefit? They got faster. What was the downside? Blue screens of death. Because now when the graphics subsystem went down, the entire system went down. And so what has newer versions of Windows done? You know, after that was like NT4 and, you know, they try to do something else. They try to isolate the driver somewhat, but they're still kind of in memory and stuff. And so bad drivers, the way Microsoft has mostly dealt with this is quality assurance on the drivers, practices and stuff on how to do it. You know, do this, but still, can those drivers take out your entire system? Oh, certainly yes. The Linux kernel, there's no expectation of this actually working well, of these drivers, except that most Linux kernel drivers are part of the Linux kernel source. They are in tree. They are visible to the kernel developers. They might be developed by some random third party, but the good ones are all incorporated into the main tree. And that means that when you do global search and replace, you look for problems, find them. They're all part of the same code base that can be maintained for years. And this is why the Linux kernel has much better support for older hardware. It's because the older hardware's drivers are still in the Linux kernel source tree, and they get maintained along with the rest of them. The internal API gets changed. That code gets changed along with this one. Now, if anyone uses it, they'll find the bugs. If no one uses it, they may bit wrong for a while. Oh, wow, that driver doesn't work anymore. But it doesn't automatically just perfectly work the code, just go away. It's carried along.
When most of the drivers are developed out of tree, Microsoft doesn't have access to the source of most of the drivers on its system. They're reliant on third parties doing that development. And so they try to treat them as extensions, try to isolate them off, try to do some quality assurance stuff, and then they just say, okay, go away. We're not going to let your old drivers run on our new system. we've changed our APIs. We're not going to sign your code. Unless you'll find, you'll have a newer Windows box of like, wait, why doesn't it support this, you know, card I had or this, you know, video camera or whatever. It's like, because they moved on where you find the Linux kernel still supports it. It's all this in kernel versus out of kernel, in tree versus out of tree development.
But then what happens if you're a driver for the Linux kernel and you're outside of the tree? Anyone know the whole NVIDIA debate in the Linux kernel world? So if you have an Intel board, if you have Intel graphics, Linux driver support for Intel graphics is very good because the Intel drivers are open source and they're developed and they're incorporated into the Linux kernel tree and they're the base ones and stuff. It's all very open. AMD and NVIDIA have some support for open source drivers, but their main high performance drivers are all proprietary. They don't give out the source code. They do not live in the tree with the Linux kernel. So what is this? What happens with this? Well, one consequence is when the Linux kernel undergoes significant changes, which it does all the time, those drivers break. You might say, well, why do they just break? Well, it's because the kernel, Linux kernel actually specifically does not guarantee any sort of stable API for modules. It doesn't. Windows does, but the Linux kernel guarantees no stable API.
Why do you think that is?
Linux kernel certainly does guarantee certain stable APIs. The whole system call interface is very stable. They don't break that. The proc files, proc and sys are relatively stable, but definitely the system call API is very stable. Those do not change. Well, they change, but they maintain backwards compatibility. But Linux kernel modules, you load the Linux kernel module, you compile it for one version of a kernel, it will not load on another version of the kernel, even for a minor release. It won't work. And that's because the internal symbols are constantly changing. It's like, why? You might say, well, why can't the Linux kernel maintain a stable extension API? What would that mean? That would mean that the internal organization of the Linux kernel would have to remain fixed in place. Or they would have to implement some sort of translation layer inside the Linux kernel in order to deal with things. And they say they don't want to do that. So we're almost done here. But what we're trying to talk about in this lecture is trying to get your head around this idea, well, you have this big application, how does it get extended? And I'm saying this is a pattern that you see all around you. And what varies is, you know, is the code you're bringing, is it in process or is it out of process? And then what sort of guarantees are presented to it? In general, out of process API guarantees are much better than the ones in process. If you try to guarantee an API in process, it typically limits the design space that you can work in as an application developer. Now, all of a sudden, your internal data structures have to maintain certain things because someone else is going to rely on it. You can't just change their code and say, well, I've changed that data structure. Well, no, you can't change that data structure because they depend on that data structure being certain. If it's a protocol, you can always have protocol translators. Those are typically pretty easy. So the Linux kernel specifically said it's out of process, out of the kernel, we'll keep a stable API. In, we won't. And that's unusual for operating systems. Particularly proprietary operating systems like Windows, Mac OS, they have to maintain stable extension level things because they want third parties to develop code for their system. And it causes the problems. And I will stop there.